MGM was preparing its most important picture at the time, which was Quo Vadis. I, of course, wanted to do it. I asked my agent to talk to Mr. L.K. Sidney about it, and he told me that Sidney has some difficulties, but he is very anxious to get the picture for me. One day he asked me to come to see him, and he told me that there is a production manager who is setting up the production in Europe, and inasmuch as the picture will cost $7 million, an unheard of sum at the time in 1950, they want to keep the costs down as much as possible, and this manager is recommending cheaper European composers. He gave me a list to look it over, and he wanted to know my recommendations. There were absolutely impossible names, impossible for Quo Vadis, and I told him so. However, I found one name, which was William Walton, and I told point blank to Mr. Sidney that if you get William Walton for this picture, you don't need me. And he asked why. I said, because he's a great composer. Well, he shrugged his shoulders and he said, I will let you know. Soon after, he called me again into his office, and he was an enormous man, very imposing, and he embraced me. He said, you got the picture. The producer at the time was Arthur Hornblow, Jr., and the director was supposed to be John Huston. I got a script, because I knew the novel by Sienkiewicz since I was a child, but the script was very exciting and a tremendous amount of opportunities for music. So I had a conference with Mr. Hornblow, and I told him that I want to be very authentic in this picture. I told him that I read an expose by Hugh Gray, a very old friend of mine from my Denham days. He was one of them who wrote the lyrics to the Russian songs in Night Without Armor in 1936, and we have been friends ever since. And he wrote a brilliant essay about Roman customs, Roman architecture, Roman instruments, and everything pertaining to the period of Quo Vadis. So I said, if you go to this much of a authenticity, which is wonderful, then I think the music should be as authentic as possible. And he said, yes, I agree with you, go ahead and do all your research and produce the music you want to write for this picture. So I started to work first alone, getting a tremendous amount of books and material from first century Rome, and then we actually wrote the songs, the hymns, the choruses together with Hugh Gray. And I don't think we ever got to it that we could play the music to Mr. Hornblow, because I suddenly was told that both Hornblow and Houston were taken off the picture and they were replaced by Sam Zimbalist as producer and Mervyn LeRoy as director. Zimbalist I did not know personally. I saw him often in the commissary. He always sat at the same table with his friends, and it impressed me very much that this man, who was at this time a very important producer, did not eat at the executive dining room, where only producers and a few directors could enter, apart from the so-called front office gentlemen, but he ate with his friends. He was a very tall man. He carried himself with a certain dignity. He was, I would say, easily 6'2" or 6'4", with a large frame, and very sympathetic looking, but I didn't know him. Finally, the time came when everybody was preparing to leave for Rome. I wasn't. I was not told that I will go to Rome. I was only told to prepare the music. But there was a lot of music to prepare. There was a song of Nero, which he sang when Rome burned. There was a hymn of the Vestal Virgins. There were the choruses in the arena of the early Christians. There was a baptismal hymn when St. Paul meets St. Peter, and many other things, an Assyrian dance and a bacchanal, which had to be done before the picture was shot. But the general understanding was that I do all these things in Hollywood. I actually make pre-recordings of it as much as possible, and they take it, and somebody in Rome will take care of the rest. Again, it was this production manager who wanted to keep costs down. He didn't want me to come there. And in front of me, I said, well, plenty of musicians in Rome. We can get somebody to do it. But he was a great connoisseur, of course, as you find so many in the film studios. And one day, I would say about 2-3 weeks before the whole company was leaving, and the whole company consisted of a lot of people for Rome, I was asked to play some of the music for Mr. LeRoy, who should have an idea what he's going to direct to. One of them was The March, which later became very famous in America, and thousands of marching bands are playing this Hail Nero march. And this had to be naturally recorded with a smallish orchestra, that they can shoot the actual marching to it. Well, we went through all the music, played the march, played all the songs, and so forth. And then he got very restless and said, well, I have to go now. Well, anyway, I'll see you in Rome and we'll discuss the details. And I said, well, I'm terribly sorry to tell you, but you're not going to see me in Rome. And he said, what do you mean? He said, because I am not invited to go to Rome. Well, he just couldn't understand. I said, we are taking grips and electricians and all the camera people and all the technical equipment to Rome, and we are not taking a composer. I said, sorry, Mervyn, but that's how it is. So he didn't even talk to Zimbalist, who was, after all, the producer, but ran straight to Louis B. Mayer's office, who was the head of the studio, and told him this. Well, Mayer, of course, was not informed about these details, and he was, as I later was told by Mervyn LeRoy, appalled. He said, he doesn't understand what kind of a arrangement is that. Of course you take the composer with you. So he came back to me, and he said, boy, you are coming. Start packing. Soon after, I was asked to go to see Mr. Mayer, and this was the only time that we spoke. And he said that he heard that I'm going to Rome and wished me all the luck, and he just wanted to discuss the music with me. Now, this, I said, is going to be something. Louis Mayer discussing the music of the first century. He said, well, for the early Christians, I want to have a music like Kol Nidre. So I said, yes, by Bruch. I said, I don't know what you're talking about. This is an old Hebrew song which every Jew knows, and that should be there. I said, Mr. Mayer, this is a melody from the 16th century, which a German composer, Max Bruch, adapted for the cello, and therefore everybody really knows it. But it would be absolutely ridiculous to use it as a first century melody. Well, he said, well, you know more about these things, but you know what I mean. And he started to sing the Kol Nidre, which did not resemble to Brooks at all. I said, yes, Mr. Mayer, that's the kind of a music I would like. Anyway, I just want to get out from there as soon as possible. The music slowly was assembled, and just before I left, about a week before, Elkie Sidney asked me to lunch with him at the executive dining. Now, this was the holy of holies. I mean, the producers, the executives, would not sit down in the general restaurant with the misera plebs, the working man, who actually did the pictures, but they wanted to be surrounded by the producers, the very highly paid directors, anyway, the kind of people they were. So a musician, of course, was never invited there. There was one producer on the lot to whom I was introduced at least five or six times during his years from 1948 to 1950. And every time he said, how do you do? And I said, how do you do? And the next day he saw, he looked over me and he just didn't recognize me. Again came up, people were around, he said, do you know Mr. Roja? And he said, how do you do? And I said, how do you do? The next day again he didn't greet me. Finally, I didn't greet him too either, and suddenly this gentleman comes in, and Elke Sidney says, well, you know my friend Miklos? And he says, well, of course, we are old friend Miklos and I. From then on, he was greeting me first. I was having lunch at the right of Elke Sidney, who was the head of the studio. Now about the music. As I said before, I was striving for authenticity. And this was not easy. As a matter of fact, about Roman music of the first century, we know practically nothing. We know that there was a lot of music. We know the instruments. Many of them survived. Many of them survived in statuary. We know their descriptions. But actually, music of the first century in Rome did not survive. Therefore, I had to recreate some sort of a music by deductions. My theory was that inasmuch as culture in Rome was mostly imitated from Greek culture, Nero himself preferred to speak Greek instead of Latin. He was surrounded by Greek teachers, philosophers, artists. Therefore, inasmuch as the Romans took over also the Greek religion, music also had to come from Greece, as most of the so-called Roman statuary, which we now admire in the Vatican Museum and other places, are copies of Greek originals which do not exist anymore. Fortunately, we know much more about Greek music. Theoretical works have survived, and actually 11 to 12 melodies, sometimes only fragments, but sometimes a whole hymn written on a tombstone, because the Greeks did have their own musical notation. The only thing they didn't have was a rhythmical organization. They actually wrote the notes, but no rhythm. However, these hymns always went together with words. We can, from the words, from the value of the words, reconstruct easily the rhythm of these melodies. Sometimes, in longer hymns, probably there wasn't a rhythm, what we call. It was sometimes like a plain song, which also comes from the same source. Anyway, there was something to start with, something, a point of departure. As a matter of fact, I used all 11 fragments, sometimes two bars, sometimes just a turn of phrase in the picture, and developed it, sometimes to a sequence of 3-4 minutes. Another problem was harmonization, because all this music was unison. They sang unison, they accompanied in unison, therefore harmony, or let alone counterpoint, was completely unknown, as the music was from orphans. I knew that I cannot write a whole musical score, an hour and a half, playing unison. This would not have had any dramatic values for a modern audience. But I had to find some kind of a harmonization, and mostly a modal one, which was based on Greek modes. And even if this is not 100% genuine, because this kind of harmonization comes actually in the early Middle Ages, it sounded archaic enough that you found it, that it's from the century. However, choruses songs were performed only in unison as they were actually in the first century. So I wrote a lot of music and made pre-recordings in Hollywood that I could go in Rome fully prepared. Before I went, I was called in to Mr. Mannix's office. Mannix was, I think at this point, studio manager. I found him a real wonderful man. He was a stocky, smallish, very strong Irishman who, as I was told, the beginning of his career was a bodyguard of one of the executives, and as he had a very good head, he was scrupulously honest. He became a studio executive, and as far as I remember, at this time he was a studio manager. He was rough, he was outspoken, but he was honest. So he called me in his office and said, "I hear that you're going to Rome." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, we don't need you there for all the time. We need you at the beginning to set up the whole production and find an assistant who can take over from you. And then when you finish that, a month later, you have to come back." I said, "Yes, Mr. Mannix." And he said, "That's not all. We are doing a picture at the moment in London for the second Mrs. Miniver, and we want you to do that as well." Well, I told him, "Mr. Mannix, if the price to go to Rome is to conduct tomorrow the symphony orchestra on the moon, I am willing to do it." Well, he laughed and he said, "Good luck." I found him, especially in Rome, extremely nice, extremely charming, and later, in his later years, because by that time he already had a heart attack, he was always extremely kind and extremely nice to me. But I can only remember with a certain nostalgia of this kind of a film man who was really 100% legit. And one cannot find these two people very often. I got to know Zimbalist really only in Rome. There he became slowly a really and a true friend. He also was honest. He was intelligent and he was very clever. He started out as a cutter and worked himself up to be a producer. Therefore, he really knew his business. And I don't know why, because our whole background was so entirely different, we became friends. He knew that he could trust me, and I knew that I could trust him. And I think this is the basis of every friendship. This friendship lasted actually until his untimely death. And it is sad somewhat to say that during these 14 years I've spent MGM Studios, he was the only man who just called up whether he wanted something or not, and said, come over, let's talk. And we talked about everything for hours, mostly, of course, about his problems with new film, about the casting, about the new director, about the problems of the studio, about general politics, about art, of which he knew very little, but he was very eager to absorb whatever I could offer in this subject. In other words, he was a friend, and there was no one else in the studio, especially not in the higher echelon, to whom I could go with my problems, and actually to whom he could go with his problems. As I have agreed with Mr. Mannix, I will go to Rome to set up the production, musically speaking, find an assistant who can stay with the whole production and who will know my intentions, and then return to California. Well, I tried to find an Italian assistant. I talked to practically all the composers or musical technicians who were doing such a job, and soon enough I found out that they haven't got the faintest idea of musical synchronization which was required in an American motion picture. So I really didn't know what to do when finally I decided to telephone Muir Mathieson to London and ask him to recommend somebody. He recommended a young man, Marcus Dodds, who arrived soon, and I was extremely pleased with him. He was a splendid musician. He knew every work that was required in a motion picture studio, and I could leave everything in his hands. Later, he made his own very brilliant career as a composer and a conductor in London. I also had to find a choreographer. Now, this was not as easy as one would think, because naturally I didn't know anybody in Italy, let alone in Rome, and I had to rely on the production people, and for them a choreographer meant a musical. So I have seen many people, they are all for varieties or light musicals, and of course that's not what I wanted. I could hardly imagine a choreographer who has done only light musicals on stage or variety shows now suddenly come up with a Roman ballet. So I, after having seen many people, I went to Zimbalist and I told him that I had just heard that the maybe most important choreographer in Europe, Serge Liffard, whom I used to see often in the Paris Opera, is in Florence at the Maggio Musicale, and could I go to see him? Well, he said, go ahead. At the same time, I found out that there is another very important choreographer who was the choreographer of the Rome Opera and also in the Scala, Aurelio Milos. Well, I had two men to talk to, and I was off to Florence. Now, I don't want to discover Florence for my readers, but after living 10 years in California, and then suddenly step back into this incredibly beautiful city and step back into the Renaissance, it was an unforgettable experience. My meeting with Serge Lifar was set up at the Excelsior Hotel, where we had lunch. Well, since the days I have seen him in L'après-midi d'un faune, which he has recreated after Nijinsky, or Icar, a ballet for which Honegger composed a percussion score, I must say that he has aged considerably, but I'm sure that so did I. Well, I told him what we want him for, and he was interested. At this time, he had his own company, because he did not belong to the opera anymore. I asked him what happened. So I found that because I came to America and I was representing an American company there, he was unburdening and he wanted to set his own record straight. Well, he told me that he became the director of the opera at the time when the Germans were occupying Paris, and he was sleeping at home one night when the concierge of the opera telephoned him and told him, "Venez vite, Hitler est arrivé." Well, he jumped out of his bed, jumped into his car, and was 10 minutes later at the opera. There was the whole état-major of the German army, who were just occupying Paris, and Hitler's wish was to see the opera. As he wanted to become an architect, he knew the plans of the Paris Opera very well, and he wanted to see it.